Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. I absolutely love mine. I know I always say it, but it's true. I do. Every time I go to cook, it's just there, you know, pasta, rice, vegetables, boiling water. I make my coffee in the morning, little espresso, top it up with boiling hot water, my tea in the afternoon, like a cup of tea in the afternoon. I can't remember the last time I had a kettle. Love it. More information on it, go to cooker.co.uk. Today's hour is 15 questions to Jeff Norcott. Well, I say 15 questions. I think regular listeners will know now. I get through about six or seven of them. And it's so sad because sometimes they prepare all their answers. But, you know, I just talk too much, don't I, as you know. Well, they don't prepare the answers. They just look to the questions. And sometimes I finish and they go, I wanted to answer that question. So I like the idea. They like the idea of getting questions. I send them through before the interview so they know what they're going to get asked. And, you know, I think that's the best way of doing it. Anyway, Jeff Norcroft is the guest today. He's got a new book out, Where Did I Go Right? So we'll find out about that. He's got a podcast called What Most People Think, and I like listening to that. What else has he been doing recently? Well, you know him from the MASH report, don't you? I mean, he was on that for a while. And you see him on Question Time every now and then. Anyway, I think this will be interesting because we're not just going to talk about politics. Well, we probably will a bit, probably will a lot. But, you know, we'll talk about all sorts of different things. Let's meet him. Here's Jeff Norcott. Jeff, hi, how you doing?
I'm not bad. Well, I'm a bit hungover.
Oh, are you? Oh, good. I like interviewing people hungover. My favourite guests on Sunday brunch are always guests who are hungover. So
not wildly, but I went out with there's a massive name drop early on, but I went out with Romish last night and we got pretty drunk, man, on gin and tonic. And I know that different alcohols aren't supposed to produce a different kind of drunkenness, but I would disagree with that. I think gin and tonic is a specific kind of drunk, but I feel all right now, but I can tell my voice is a bit different, you know, there's a slight baritone nature to it.
So, someone once said to me, I agree with you totally. Someone once said to me, work out what sort of drunk you get with each sort of spirit and alcohol. Yeah. And that's why I kind of really stick to beer, basically, because spirits, I'm really mouthy. And I've lost a lot. I really tell people what I think. And I think it's funny at the time.
I just want to get drunk with you on spirits now. Because the thing is, when people tell anybody their worst characteristic while drunk, all the other person thinks is, I want to see that. I want to give that Tim a run around. I want to be near what happens then. Yeah. The funny thing was, I was on the train on the way back and I was just to put up a podcast I did with Matt Ford. And I thought I could edit it while drunk on the train on the way back. And it was hilarious listening to it this morning. Some of the stings that I've put in are just so clunky. And I thought, oh, that's a really good point. I'll use a sting to end with that. But it was very drunkenly done.
I've just been listening to that podcast. It's What Most People Think. And Matt's great. You're great. It's great. It's a really good listen. It's really, you know, I get so sick of politics, and it's really nice for people to be talking about politics in a humorous way, but with lots of sense as well. I mean, it's unusual, isn't it? Sense and politics, they don't really go hand in hand.
Well, yeah, no, and Matt, he just, I mean, he's ridiculous. If you listen to it, you'll end up thinking, why isn't this guy in politics? Because he's such a clear thinker. And you know, I mean, we're sort of different in a way, because I think Matt is the guy that really does know about politics, whereas I'm partially informed, and that's exactly how I intend to keep it. I want to know a normal amount about politics and reserve my right to spout off about it nevertheless.
Yeah, but isn't it tough for you because you've set your stall out as the only right-wing comedian or whatever you are?
There's a few now, mate, you know?
The only comedian who votes Conservative, whatever you are, is on the bill posters or whatever.
Yeah. Do you not have Tory in the village?
Yeah. Don't you have to be informed? Like, don't you feel you have to be?
Yeah. Yeah. But I think, I mean, look, I devour politics and I'm really into it. But I do think, if I'm honest with myself, I do have a slightly tabloidy personality, right? When I look at tabloid newspapers and they have a bit of politics on the front page, then they have something about a holiday in the top corner. Then there used to be a nice looking lady quite quickly. And then there's a lot of sport. I thought that's me, you know. Yeah. I think that's one of the reasons tabloids are successful, is they sort of, people think that tabloids form the national conscience. I actually think that they're in some ways a consequence of it. They reflect it back to you. So I am, yeah, I mean, I probably am more gemmed up these days. And especially when you go on shows like Question Time, you're sort of like, you just don't want to know nothing. I mean, when I was on it once, I did play the, it was when COVID was starting actually last year. And I just said, you know what? I'm going to save you all a bit of time by saying, I don't think you need to hear from a comedian about this. Right. It got around applause. But then I sort of thought, I think on Question Time, you only get to play that card once.
Right. Okay. Yeah, yeah. I tell you what, I've changed my news habits now because my mate Steaders, he said to me one day, I asked him a question or something. He said, I don't know. And I'm like, what do you mean you don't know? You know, you should have an opinion on everything. He says, I've stopped doing it because I've stopped looking at all the news and going on social media because I just keep having fictitious debates with myself in my head. And I was like, I was like, geez, that's what I do constantly because I'll read something that you write or Piers Morgan write or Ramesh writes or someone on Twitter. And I start thinking about it and start playing out the argument. It's draining, isn't it, after
it is. And I do think increasingly I'm definitely less combative than I was, you know, like in the real kind of fulcrum of the Brexit years. I've definitely chilled out a bit. And I just think certainty perhaps is the only thing that I take issue with now, is people just, it makes me laugh. You know, I'm sort of envious when people just think there's an absolute right way. And I think that there's so many examples currently. I mean, even what's going on in the Labour Party, it's completely not obvious what they should do next. The centrists will say, oh, we just need to stick with Starmer and stuff, you know, and have a moderate way. But then, you know, the hard left have an argument as well. So I've just become more of an interested observer. You know, I'm certainly, you know, I'm always naturally probably going to lean more towards the Tories, but you know, I'm more of a conservative voter than a Tory, if you get my drift.
Yeah, I was going to say you're part of the problem because part of the problem is people who only vote one way. Have you only ever voted that way? Or
No, I voted Labour first two times I could vote. Then I voted Lib Dems in 2005. We all have a Lib Dem phase. You know, it's like experimenting. It's like experimenting at college, isn't it? You know, things happened. We learned. And then, yeah, it was from about 2010 onwards. But then I've sort of realised things about myself, and this certainly came out in writing the book, was just that I think a lot of the stick that I've taken has probably radicalised me to be a bit more Tory than I probably intended, if you get my drift. And I think that is probably true of quite a few people, you know, just average voters that thought, oh, on this occasion, I'm going to vote Tory, you know, for this reason, right? Or maybe specifically for Brexit, or because of they felt that we needed a bit of austerity or whatever. And then they look online and then suddenly they're this selfish bastard. And it's hard to come back from that when your former wing of politics, like you did one thing that they didn't want. And then suddenly, same with Brexit, stupid, racist, selfish. A lot of these insults have made it very hard for the left to reclaim people, I think, you know, because a lot of bridges have been burnt.
Yeah, it's really funny, though. I think I might have stolen this off you, but I was talking to my mates the other day and we were saying, you know, we all sort of, I think most of me and my mates sit in the middle-ish, you know, and we look over at the Tories and look over at Labour and stuff like that. And at the moment, Labour's not looking great and Tories got Boris in it or whatever. And we're thinking, why isn't there someone for us in the middle? And Lib Dems must be sitting. The one chance they have to suck us all up and they're not there anymore. What happened to them? They've just disappeared.
They're like, you know, it's like that American sitcom trope. Hello, I'm literally right here. They're standing there. I mean, when Change UK started, that was hugely offensive to the Lib Dems because what people were saying was like, it would just be great if there was sort of like a centrist party that were really like pro-EU and kind of, and the Lib Dems, that's exactly what we are. And for some reason, but I do think the Lib Dems, maybe they stick around, you know, I think they're a bit like print media.
Yeah.
Where there'll just be this slow managed decline. There'll always be some people that want to read physical newspapers. Mm. There'll always be some Lib Dems. But I do wonder now, they used to be the protest vote, didn't they? By-elections and whatnot. But I wonder if the Green Party will become that now. It's people that want to feel kind of radical, that want to register something against the government, but aren't happy with Labour. So I think a lot more people will start voting Green.
Mr. Binface or whatever his name is, didn't he get 2,500 votes in the mayoral election?
Count Binface. He had a radical agenda. Something about capping the price of croissants.
Yeah, that was it. You're only ever allowed to charge a quid for a croissant. I think it was a good policy.
I don't know, man. Some of my middle class mates were like, you know what? This guy's talking a lot of sense.
Right, we've got 15 questions. Just before that, though, is I didn't know you had a book out when I went, hold on a second, I should get Jeff back on this podcast. And I've seen the book. I haven't read it yet. You're coming on. I'm doing this before you come on Sunday brunch, which is on Sunday, because this will go after that. And I've yet to receive my copy of the book to read before the show. So can you tell me what it's about now? And then I don't have to read it.
Yeah, basically, it's called Where Did I Go Right? How the Left Lost Me. And one thing that I got asked most commonly, right, was having been brought up on a council estate, you know, having two disabled parents and a trade union father. Although I should say he was from London. A lot of people just presume Northerner then. They just think that my dad was some bloke. There's something about trade union that makes you think my dad was going, hey, one out, all out, you know, down tools. It wasn't exactly like that, right? But having come from that background, people would always say, well, how the hell did you end up voting for that lot? And I thought, you know what? It's a good question. So I wanted to explore my bias. You know, so I start off the book sort of saying, I am biased. You're going to read things that you'll think, well, that's a bit biased. And go, well, absolutely. Of course I'm biased. But where did it come from? And then just by kind of a sort of part memoir and looking at my parents and the big totemic political events of my lifetime, just try to chart that journey. And the interesting thing is that obviously, you know, the Brexit vote happened and there were the last general election, a lot of working class people migrated over to the Tories and people thought, oh, is that just a one-off? And then these recent local election results, I think were really important in a way because it kind of consolidated that. So it sort of seems like I'm not alone in a way. And I think that I do care about the left and I want good opposition. So I suppose it's a question that they're going to have to reckon with, like that maybe there are quite a few Jeffs out there, which is an awful thought for a lot of people. But, you know, the numbers suggest that there are.
Have you always been politically engaged then, do you think?
Yeah, no, my family were. My mum, she stood as, I don't know if they're Lib Dems then, but she stood as a councillor. I don't know if she just did that to piss off my dad, but my parents, I mean, a lot of this book is me trying to just tell you some stories about my parents as well. They were just really maverick, off the wall people, and neither of them are with us anymore. But that clarity of them not being around in a way, it gives you a really objective view of your parents. I can just see there's a lot of stuff when you're a kid, you think, oh, well, you know, that's just what mums and dads do. And it turns out in my case, almost no mums and dads did that. You know what I mean? My dad once pulled over a policeman in a car, tried to arrest the copper, basically. Because he was driving a car and the old Bill pulled him over and he didn't have a seatbelt on. And so they were quite young coppers and they patronised him in the way that they do. They sort of enjoyed it too much. And then when they pulled away, he saw that neither of them were wearing seatbelts. So he pulled them over and got out of the car and took great pleasure in sort of echoing their language back to them.
Right.
But then unfortunately for him, one of them clocked me, he had a minicab in aerial on, asked him if he was declaring the revenue. He wasn't. He got 40 hours community service.
I always find it weird when people aren't politically engaged because my family, I just assumed everyone was like my family. Sunday lunch. Sit there with the grandparents. One set of grandparents was a postman and a dinner lady. The other set, they'd had their own off license. He'd worked in a tool factory, blah, blah, blah. My parents, and they would sit there and discussing the bin men, basically the bin crisis of the bin men going on strike. And then there was constant immigration, whatever discussions. So I just sat there bored as a kid listening to it all. And then as I grew older, it just sort of, you know, obviously I just had an interest because I've been listening to it. But I didn't realize that didn't happen around every kid. Kitchen table and
no
so it's you know it's fascinated me that but I've always because of listening to the views of grandparents everything I've always thought both ways, you know. I've always looked at Tories and not hated them, Labour and not hated them either, so I find this like picking it like a football team, picking a party like a football team. I always find that quite, I understand it, but I always find it quite weird.
What you mean? Are you like some sort of fantasy football thing? And you go, well, you know, you'd have Yvette Cooper there just on the centre right. You know, you'd have, you know, Ken Clark. He can still do a job there at right back.
He can, yeah.
There's a lot of politics. And me and Matt were talking about this. That is sort of like sports / entertainment. That is the way that I consume it. And that's something that I come up against is the way that I talk about it. People think I'm being smug or bombastic. But I'm not offended by stuff people say to me, but a lot of people really are supercharged about this stuff. I mean, you know, and some of the reactions you get when you do question time, you sort of think, are you really angry about me or politics, or is there other stuff wrong in your life?
Yeah.
And you've had a couple of glasses of Merlot, you're sitting late at night watching question time, and this Jeff Norcott Pratt's come on and he gets it.
I want to get onto these questions, but just quickly before you do that, PMQs, have you ever been there?
No, I really want to go though. But I really want to go.
You've got to, because I went and watched it live, and it is the most amazing thing, because you sort of lose all respect for politicians when you watch them like children going rah, 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 rah at each other. And you're like, I was sitting with my friend going, I cannot believe this lot are running the country. It's so childish. I watched it with Cameron and Miliband. And Cameron strolled in. Miliband looked so nervous. I can't tell. It was like a sporting event. Absolutely like a sporting event. And he was shuffling his papers and he was there first. Miliband strolls in. He's like, he's got his chest out. He was the governor. And it was. And then every time Miliband said something remotely digging at Cameron, the whole of the Labour Party would be up like, it's like he'd scored a goal. And then Cameron would come back and the Tories were. It was just mental. The whole thing was ridiculous. It was like, aren't these people going to have an adult mature conversation? No, it's just a stupid thing.
I mean, I'm just loving the idea of Miliband trying to front it, coming in with his chest puffed out. I mean, just the idea of Ed Miliband. One of my favorite political moments is in 2015 when Paxman said to him, Ed Miliband, are you tough enough? And Miliband went, of course I'm toffee nuts. I mean tough enough. And it was just you know, sometimes when you're not ready for something and your brain will intervene to fuck you up because it sort of thinks, I don't know if we are tough enough. It was He's a good man, Ed Miliband, but you know, the fact he's sort of drifted off into podcasting suggests that maybe he had a different fate.
Yeah, well. Right, what one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Well, because I don't deal in certainty, it was going to have to be something practical for this. So I would say, remember all the important numbers in your life, right? Passport number, driving license number, account, sort code, all this stuff, because there are certain crucial moments, like where just you'll be so smug and happy that you did that when you just know it. But national insurance number, you get asked these things a lot. You don't have to, just keep them in your head. And you know, the best time, Tim, for that is when, you know, when we're soon allowed back on planes, is when you have to fill out a landing card, right? And it's such a shock to the system at the end of this journey. You've had wine, you've watched films, it's been emotional. And all of a sudden, you've got to do a bit of admin right at the arse end of it. And I never feel ready. I never feel ready for the admin. But if I know my passport number, when you board the flight, screenshot the flight number, just make your life easier. So that is probably the only piece of advice that I'm 100% certain about, is remember your important numbers.
That's a great. I don't know any of mine. I don't even know the reg of my car. I know my phone number, my parents' phone number, and I know about three or four of my mates' phone numbers from when they were kids. You know, their landlines.
I still tell you my first girlfriend's phone number. I mean, that would be, you know, wrong. But I think it was 01 back then. I can just remember going there to the phone. I mean, this is a quick way of us both sound like old bastards, but, you know, I'll go there to the team down the phone, but you don't really have phone boxes now, do you? But yeah, do you remember that? Sorry, this is a slight tangent, but do you remember when people used to go in phone boxes before you and they would smoke in a phone box? It's just one of the most incredibly selfish things.
I was trying to tell one of my mates the other day about one of my girlfriends. I mean, it's quite unusual, but I used to have to phone our neighbour and say, can you tell Annette to go to the phone box? I want to ring her. And it was like, because her family didn't have any money. She was just bought by a single mum. And so the only way they would do it, the only way to contact her was she'd have to go and stand outside the phone box. We are sounding old now, aren't we?
But that, I mean, what's hilarious about that is that sounds like a sort of KGB maneuver. You know, tell Annette that the weather in Volgograd is very good. And then she would just march in.
And then you'd
hit a map, but no.
You bring it sometimes and you go, and then there'd be someone else answer. You go, is there a girl standing there? Because I'm phoning for her. And the person would go, I've got to phone my mum. Can you phone back in 5 minutes? You go, yeah, we'll tell her to wait then, will you? And you have this conversation with someone about it's nuts. Absolutely that's nuts. Fine. Right. What's the best moment of your career?
Well, look, this is going to sound like a bit predictable, but I think with comedy, it's often what's the recent thing that you did that you got a buzz out of, because it's a very fast moving art form. And I just think getting the book out and the reaction about, not the politics weirdly, but people telling stories about my parents back to me, people like identifying with them, you know, because in terms of losing them and losing various people in my life, like it's taken a long time for me to come to terms with that grief, but just getting their stories kind of out there and just how kind of rich they were. I mean, like, they certainly left me with a lot of anecdotes, you know, in terms of what was the inheritance. They just left me with a lot of stories. My mum was every bit, you know, was off the walls. My dad, I remember when they were getting divorced, I was claiming that I was being victimized by a teacher. And a lot of kids do that. Well, she just doesn't like me. You know, I think she's a feminist. You know, I was throwing everything out there. And there was these partitions between the two classes. So what happened was I went to school. To my knowledge, my mum had gone home. What she'd actually done was embedded herself between the two walls of the class to listen in like a spy on what was happening and hear for herself.
Wow.
And then when this teacher, I won't say her name, but when this teacher, she told me off. Now, I might have deserved it to him. I honestly don't remember. My mum appeared from this little gap, right? Come out of a fucking wall, right? She come out of a wall, grabbed the teacher by her wrist, and she went, right, I've heard it with my own ears now. You, my girl, are going to the head teacher. What a like a humiliating thing. And a lot of people like listening now, you might think that's hilarious that your mum did that, but a lot of people will rightly think, what an awful thing to do as well to a teacher. And yeah. I've been a teacher myself. Yeah. I mean, I can see that, but what I particularly remember was being in shock, but then looking around at the rest of the class who were also in shock and sort of thinking that my power base had been shored up there. Sort of looking at kids going, yeah, that's what happens. You mess with old Jeff, people appear out of walls.
did you find writing the book easy?
Not easy. Once I got a structure to doing it, it was a long process of thinking about stories, and I just had notes on my iPhone and thinking, remembering kind of anecdotes and stuff. Once I started typing, particularly when it came to the anecdotes, I enjoyed that. But then there's this thing called structure, you know, yeah. And that's what a publisher is good
for. Is it hard to get humour in it, though, to write humour?
I think, yes, yeah, basically, in a nutshell, because I sort of had certain jokes in, I just thought, God, that feels clunky as you like, do you know what I mean? Like, it actually got in the way of what, you know, and I know that's a very kind of Edinburgh fringy view of it. I'd never apply that to stand-up, you know, when you get these critics at the fringe who go, actually, the jokes got in the way of the humour. I'm like, no, the jokes are the most important thing. But in a book, it's slightly different. And, you know, I had a point, you know, that I was trying to make across the book. And that was the hard thing, was standing back from it sometimes and finishing it as well. Jeez, in the end, I was really happy with the ending we got to. But I'm really glad that the publisher sort of pushed me on that, because I think my first efforts were sort of almost like, and that's how I became a Tory, you know. Who's like,
all right, what's the worst moment of your career?
Worst moment was, I think, after I turned professional, right? So you got to bear in mind, when I met my missus, I was working in advertising, and then a career change to be a teacher. So I proposed very early as well. So all this sort of thing is the stuff that will rattle in-laws. Like, who is this guy? He's a bit off his head. He's already changed careers once. And then I was like, do you know what? I'm going to be a comedian now. Then I could have said I'm going to be a professional BMXer or something, and that probably would have sounded roughly the same to them. And then I decided to go full time. And then I was at a final of a new act competition in Brighton. And I was the favorite, you know, a lot of people were saying green room, this one's got your name on it and stuff. And I had a good position in the lineup, and I died so hard in that. I mean, it was silence for a long time. And then I started to get slow hand claps, which is an incredible emotion. Just spreading around. Like, first your optimism. Oh, did I get a clap? Oh, no, they're still. Oh, I see. I'm getting slow hand claps. But really, it was the look on my wife's face when I finished the gig and went back to her. She sort of was like, right, who exactly have I hitched my wagon to here? It was the first time she'd seen me do comedy in a little while.
I listen to a lot of comedians' podcasts in America, and it seems to me the dying bit is one of the best bits when you look back, because it's the bit which makes you strong. Is that fair to say?
Dying, I think, if you stand your ground, I think that it's how you react to it, you know, and what you do, and whether you capitulate too much, because sometimes it just wasn't your day. You know, you can only surf the waves that you're given sometimes. And just sometimes the alchemy of the situation isn't in your favor. And it's about working that out early on. And sort of thinking like, you know, I love my cricket analogies, but what's the best can I bat out for a draw here? It's sometimes, you know, maybe some people would see that as unambitious, but being able to adapt to what the room is probably the most important thing, because the worst steps I've ever seen were when the comedian ploughed a furrow that was so far away from what the room needed, and just, it starts to become surreal. But you do learn from deaths. It's a very strange thing to get your head around, because you have to have them to get better, but equally they sort of knock your confidence
I've watched a few comics die, and it's uncomfortable for the audience as well. All right, what does success mean to you?
Well, I think if you're doing like an art form, I think it's that you're still doing it. Do you know what I mean? And you're still getting better. And I take my responsibility seriously. So I've got, you know, a wife and a kid. If what I do can provide a good lifestyle for them, then that's important. I mean, I do dream of like the big financial hit. Do you know what I mean? Like, I suppose we all do. The bank, I always think about it as the bank raid, right? You know, you're holding up post offices, but what you want to do is a bank raid, you know, a high risk thing that sort of sets you up a little bit. But I suspect, given what I know now of money, is that once you do the bank raid, you probably just start thinking about the next bank raid, to be honest. I've got this cozy idea that you think, oh, right, I've got, you know, a bit of a lump sum there that will see me right. But actually, I'm guessing it doesn't work like that now. But, and also wonder if, given my personality, if I did something that just suddenly, like, you know, got sold a rights issue for a film or something that really furnished me with a lot of money, whether or not that would even be the best thing for me. I think I'm a grafter, you know, like I need to work regularly and always be doing something.
Yeah, that's in my career. I've always been desperate. I was for a while desperate to be the Saturday night TV host. You know, that's what you should be. And it never came along. Now, in retrospect, I love the fact that I've just constantly worked for the last 26, 27 years. It's been absolutely amazing.
Well, can you imagine like your 25-year-old self when you think now, you know, the age we sort of are, you go, how would I have coped? You could just see all sorts of pitfalls. Like I was nearly signed by a very big agent very early in my career. And I messed it up by not reading what was happening. I didn't realize that I was being touted out. But I think that would have been awful. You know, same as when I got 3 A's at A level, which always have to give people a second to go, what? I did. I got 3 A's at A level. But I'd overperformed, really. I'd had a day out. You know, like a really crap striker that scores a hat trick in the League Cup or 6 goals. Do you remember that guy, Frankie Bunn? I always remember him scored like, he probably wasn't. This was years ago. There was this striker that scored 6 goals in a midweek League Cup tie. And then he didn't do much else. And I sort of thought, not doing myself down, but those 3 A's weren't really representative of where I was at. So they said to me at that time, oh, you know, pull out, go Oxford or Cambridge. And I was like, something in me knew that I wasn't really ready to be at Oxford or Cambridge. And that was definitely the right thing for me.
Are you going to do, have you done much acting? Yeah, I've seen you in something, haven't I? What have I seen you in?
I was in The Duchess, Catherine Bryan's sitcom. Non-speaking part, but my face acting was amazing. Like the eyebrows were working overtime.
Are you going to do more? Because that's where comedians go for the payday, isn't it? For the cash grab.
I think it's fun acting. That's what's weird about it. I forgot I'd done it at school. You know, I was part of a like the drama group at an all boys comprehensive, which was always a bit weird, but I always enjoyed it. It's a laugh. It's just mucking about, isn't it? And I do think in acting, the jeopardy is so much lower. But equally, it's hard to know when you've done well, because there's all these people around, lights, people, director, producer, and then you have to just say a couple of things. They go, okay. You're like, okay, what? What just happened there? It's a really nebulous thing to get your head around. I can see how it does. Again, maybe I'm a grafter. Sitting in a Winnebago all day, I'd probably go slowly mad. I looked at, who is the guy? Christian Bale. You know when he kicked off on set and that Batman thing?
Yeah.
And everyone's like, oh, he's bang out of order. I thought, is he? You know, he's dressed up in all that gear. He just wants to do his Batman scene. And then some bellend has dropped a light in the background or something, whatever happened. Everyone was thinking, you know, he was bang out of order. I was thinking I'd probably be him if I was in that situation.
Yeah, everyone's very critical of everyone without understanding the scenarios that were led to it.
This week's sponsor, Clean Co, creates non-alcoholic alternatives to your favourite full-strength spirits with all the flavour but a fraction of the calories. Whether you're into gin, rum, vodka or tequila, Clean Co has a delicious option for you from just 12 calories per serve. Clean Co spirits have over 4,500 five-star reviews on Trustpilot, so head over to clean.co to ditch hangovers and drink clean. Right now at clean.co, you can get 15% off each of the spirits until the 17th of June. Reduced from £19 to £16 for a limited time only with free shipping across the UK and Ireland. Back to the podcast with this week's sponsor, Clean Co. Non-alcoholic alternatives to your favourite full-strength spirits with all the flavour, but a fraction of the calories.
What's your outstanding fashion moment? Could be good or bad.
Well, I think it was good, but I feel like I'm alone in that. It was in the late 90s. I was obsessed with U2, obsessed with Bono.
Why?
Well, this is another, you know, you talk about like being a conservative. Being a fan of U2 is way more contentious.
Definitely.
They're just the best band, Tim. Like we need to start it. They've been together the longest, the best live tours, more great albums than any other band. It's just the fact that they're still together is why we haven't got our heads around it. They're the greatest.
I don't get U2 at all. I really don't. I mean, I get the fact that everyone likes them and I get the fact that they're absolutely huge. But when I listen to it, it just doesn't... I don't think the rhythm section maybe is good enough. There's something wrong going on there. It's just not... It just doesn't hit me.
Have you just picked out Larry Mullen Jr. and Adam Clayton for criticism?
Was it Bono who said that my big regret is no one can dance to our records? Have you ever been to a U2 gig? Because I have. There's not a lot of dancing going on.
There's not a lot, but I cried quite a bit and I've had transcendent experiences. I've clapped along, done a bit of call and response with Bono. I mean, that's not worth nothing, Tim. I mean, weirdly now, not many people do like U2. There was that period where they bestrode the earth and then it sort of became more fashionable to not like them. But I've just always loved them.
It's because they put their CD on our iPhones for free. Do you remember?
Oh, what an old melodramatic reaction that was. All these people are going, hey, man, like their iPods were this sacrosanct vestige. Yeah, of
get your data off my iPod.
Get out of my iPod. Can I just say, and I am quite tetchy about this still, it wasn't actually on people's iPad. It was a free option to download, okay? It's time we have the revisionism about the U2 free download. It wasn't actually there. You could just have had it if you wanted, and people need to move on. But I was obsessed. When Bono appeared, the first ever live gig I went to was Zoo TV. When he came out in that black PVC, the fly outfit, I just thought that is the coolest thing I've ever seen. But what I didn't realise was that normal human beings probably shouldn't attempt that look.
He did that really strange dancing at the beginning of his career, didn't he? The sort of strange kicky thing he did on stage. Have you ever seen that? Someone's done a...
You mean the great kicky thing?
So what was the outfit that you wore then? What was
the outfit was a black PVC jacket, 110 quid. I had no money at this time. I used my student loan to get this. A black PVC jacket. And then I bought some fly shades as well. These were 120 quid. And then I was remember I went out shopping with my mum in Croydon wearing this gear. And I just remember people looking at me. And you know that narcissism and that ego of like boys when they're their late teens. I just thought people going, look at that awesome guy there, totally pulling off. Totally pulling off that Bono look. And I was sweating as well because it was PVC, you know.
Did you have any mates? I mean, what were they saying?
The problem was I had a girlfriend at the time, but she really liked Bono as well. So I think she probably knew I couldn't really pull it off, but she didn't mind as much. So the one person in my life, I don't know why my mum didn't call it out. She was a very direct person. I think she probably just thought it was hilarious that I was...
What were you wearing on your feet? Didn't you sort of wear winkle picker type things? Is that what you were
wearing? That was the problem with the amount of money I had. I was just wearing really tatty jeans and probably high-tech trainers. So...
Right.
The top and the bottom didn't even match. I mean, it was. I don't think I've got any photos of this, but I can't imagine. I mean, the fact it was at the Whitgift Centre in Croydon as well. I don't know why, but that makes it worse somehow.
I got to say, I'm being very hypocritical here because I met Bono once and I was a bit in awe because he's so huge. Yeah. He's such a big star. I mean, Jesus, yeah. I was at a party in a sort of club thing. You know, I was in that. It was the Eve Club. You know where the Pulp video is filmed, the Common People video? I was there at some sort of, I don't know, some weird showbiz Christmassy type thing where like big stars were just coming and getting up and singing Christmas songs. It was really weird. And I stood next to the bar and there was Manny there from Stone Roses, Primal Scream. And he went, all right, Lovejoy, And I went, hey, Manny, how are you? He goes, you met Bono? And I went, no. And he goes, here he is. And there was Bono stood there. And he went, Lovejoy, Bono, Bono, Lovejoy. And that was it. And I was shaking hands with Bono going, oh, my God, there's Bono. It's like when you see someone as big as Bono.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'd done a lot of music radio, but I'd never interviewed Bono. So I'd never got anywhere close to him.
Is he nice?
Yeah, he was just lovely bloke, you know. He's just a nice bloke. But apparently that night they all went back to a hotel room. There was, as the story goes, there's Bono, Liam Gallagher, Manny, all going back to Bono's room, which I never got the invite to, which I'd have loved to have done that. I think at the time, my girlfriend at the time was pregnant, and that's why we couldn't go back. So it's quite a long time ago, but, you know, heady days. All right, next question. Go on, sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, in terms of meeting super famous people, I once, I was doing a gig outside the box in Kingston, and the promoter said to me, you want to get yourself down there because there's somebody very famous on in the middle before you. But AFC Wimbledon had a first round FA Cup game against Wycombe Wanderers, which is nearby. I said, you know what? I said, you know what, mate, actually, I said, I think I'm going to eat. And he kept trying to say to me, look, you probably want to be at this gig, Jeff. I was like, yeah, but it's first round FA Cup. We haven't been in this since we've been formed. We got beat 4-1. I turned up at the gig and I just heard the crowd going absolutely mental, like nothing I've ever heard before. And then out on the side door comes Robin Williams, right? The wow. Robin Williams. And because he was doing a couple of UK dates. But I forgot that he didn't know who the hell I was. So I was just some dude hanging around in the rain. I went, Robin Williams. And then I went, I'm the guy that's following you. And like, that doesn't sound good. And I was like, no, I mean, like, I'm after you. And then all these people were like, okay, mate. But he was nice. I think he just about worked it out and stuff. But that theory, I don't know whether it's in your brain or whether they have the magic stardust. I've never worked it out, but it's certainly, I felt something in his presence. I think there's a few people in showbiz that still have that. You know, Tom Cruise,
Yeah, I think if you see so much of them and then you meet them, it's like I met Keanu Reeves once in a friend of mine, Dougray Scott, and I just bumped into him and we always talk about football and stuff. And he goes, you met Keanu? It's like, what? And he's just sitting there and it's really weird when stuff happens like that. And you shake hands. He goes, yeah, we're just doing a film together. And it's like, yeah, we're playing golf. Do you want to come play golf with us next week? And you're like going, oh, what day? Yeah, of course I can. I never got to play golf with them in the end, but yeah, it's funny, that sort of stuff. Yeah, they're just so big, aren't they? Right, next question. Actually, no, before we do that, I've got to half time and I want to tell you something because it's amused me so much. When last time you were on my podcast, this has always really amused me, this, and I've been waiting to tell you this for a long time. But someone in the TV industry came up to me and they're quite high up in the industry in their role. And they went to me, you've had Jeff Norcott on your podcast, haven't you? And I went, yeah. He goes, you know that stuff about, you know, being a Tory, voting Conservative? And I went, yeah. He goes, you know that's not a joke, don't you? He actually does. And I went, yeah. And they went, well, yeah, but it's not a joke. He's lit. And I was like, how the hell have we got to this stage where the idea of voting Conservative in the TV industry is seen as, you might as well, you know, be voting for the National Front or something? It's like, it's incredible.
It was mad. I think around that time, I think it was about 2018 and stuff. And I think that there was still a lot of learnings, as they say, that needed to happen. And it's always been slightly odd to me, the idea that voting in line with 42% of the country was in some way edgy. I mean, it does me favours. I'm the least edgy bloke ever. I'm basically a right-wing centrist dad. And then I've got people in the TV industry saying to Tim Lovejoy again, just so you know, okay, look, I think it's really important that you do know is that he might have done that thing that millions of other people have done. I'll get the episode taken down. Thanks for the tip off.
But it's weird, isn't it? Because I said earlier that you're the only comedian who votes Conservative. You are. I know that's not true, but it's pretty much the TV industry. It'd be very hard for me to go on TV still and go, you know, say, oh, I'm a big fan of the Tory party or something like that. People, my industry would hate me more than the viewers, I imagine. I mean, I would never do it. I don't talk about politics in the media. I can't be bothered. But it's a really strange thing. How do you think that's changing?
I think that they're realizing it has to change. I think Brexit, I think successive elections where there've been a working class you know, migration. I think TV audiences, what's happened with TV audiences. You think, well, if this group of people, if a lot of people feel disenfranchised, if we could just sort of kind of even out our relationship with that group of people, it could help mitigate some of the losses of terrestrial television. And also, I think when it comes to the BBC, it's just a moral obligation because people have to pay a license fee. So it's kind of, and I see diversity, right? You know, racial, gender diversity. I see it as a good thing. You know, there's a lot of people on the right. You know, there's people on the right that might not see that, or they criticize me for being involved with that. But I think just on broadly speaking, television, you know, should broadly reflect the society that we have in it. That's not a radical idea. But for that project to have credibility, it has to include diversity of opinion. That's the problem, is people can tap out of the idea if they see that most other forms of diversity are being honored, but not opinion, you know, not political views. So I'm behind the overall project, but you know, I was on the BBC diversity panel. I was just basically saying the same thing time and time again, is it's a very easy stick to beat the BBC with, because it's sort of kind of true, right? And I don't think that anyone wants a right-wing comedy show. I don't even know what that would look like, right? I think what a lot of people might appreciate is in topical comedy, if there was just a broader sweep of opinions, you know, if you've got seven people on a panel show, maybe one of them, and not just me, there needs to be more people than just me as well. I think that would actually benefit the whole thing. I think it'd be good for the audience. The news quiz already do that. I've been on that a few times and they've been very good at getting a real range of voices on. And I actually think it's better for the left-wing comics, because the left-wing comics, they don't no longer seem like part of this weird cultural establishment. I can say something, they can come back at me. And it's so, I'd urge anybody, if you haven't listened to the news quiz for a while, last couple of series have been really good. I mean, Andy Zaltzman's absolutely brilliant, but they've got a really good kind of chemistry at the moment.
I wonder with media and TV and stuff, whether they are subservient to social media. My next question was going to be, is going to be, what's your relationship with social media? Like, I see just a few cracks. I talk a lot with my fellow friends in social media, how we've become subservient to social media. And and I'm seeing some cracks now where I've always said it, the worst thing people could ever do was constantly sack people because of social media. It's the bosses should be the ones who go, no, we will deal with this, not you. And protect the people from the mass hordes who are coming with their pitchforks because someone had said one thing. I've always said this. It's like, you know, you can't just take one sentence and then judge a person's whole life on one sentence they said. I mean, unless it's horrific, but you know, which is what happened. And there starts to be little cracks in it now, I think. And I think people are starting to realize that social media isn't the be all and end all.
Well, I mean, it's a self-selecting focus group at best, right? In terms of Twitter, where we get social and political discourse, the vast majority of people on Twitter don't engage with it in that way. I mean, if you look at the amount of tweets there are about a disallowed goal, it's way more than anything, you know, on these cancellation type issues. You know, even if Gary Neville annoys people with his punditry, that'll get way more traffic than politics. So a small amount of people have Twitter accounts, right? And a much smaller amount engage with it. But it's very difficult, I think, maybe for TV people, is when they search the comments to get it out of their head as to how unrepresentative, you know, that is. And I worked on a show recently just helping develop stuff for Clarkson on TV, Jeremy Clarkson, just sort of like, you know, sort of satirizing television. And it was a really great show because there wasn't much said about it on Twitter, but it did really well ratings wise. I think in the early days of Twitter, there was a connection between how the audience generally felt about a show and how it did. But that's changed. A lot of people have just left Twitter because it's too toxic. And I think that if you're basing your view on how a TV show's gone on, 100 comments? I mean, that would be quite good Twitter traffic, 200 comments for a topical panel show when there was a million people watching it. I don't think that's any way forward, really. And I think you're right. I think that there is a correction, hopefully, starting to happen the other way, because the numbers tell the story, ultimately.
Yeah, I'm saying that, though. I remember being on a live TV show not so long ago. Actually, it was about 5 or 6 years ago. I can't remember what it was called now. And the presenter came in at the end and went, "Are we trending?" And I thought, that's so weird. You know, it's like that's what we're going to use now for judging whether a TV is successful or not. And then you hear about the Saturday, the late night TV shows. I mean, Ellen which has been cancelled. That's a daytime TV show. They've got 1.5 million. I mean, that's just like a TV show over here, and yet it's apparently huge. The James Corden show doesn't get... I mean, I love James Corden, by the way, and he's great, but it doesn't get these huge ratings, but they work really well on social media. So people are saying that's how they're being judged. So I suppose social media does have an impact in that way.
It has. I mean, viral clips and stuff. I mean, one of the reasons that MASH Report punched above its weight, you know, I think everybody in the show would say it did okay ratings wise, but it never sort of consistently pulled up trees. But the impact of the social media clips was what took it up to another level. But I think that this sort of content that you can disseminate is a different thing from just what people are saying about a show. You know, if you get like 100 people say, well, you know, any new sitcom, right? This is the hilarious thing I love about when a sitcom launches. I did a bit of writing for King Gary, you know, the first 10 minutes, people, you think about like how long people gave Fools and Horses and Gavin and Stacey. In the first 10 minutes, you know, the comments that you get, it kind of underlines in a way why you can't observe that. And King Gary's gone on to do like really great numbers. You know, I mean, it doesn't get commented on much because I guess it's not like one of those metropolitan friendly comedies like Fleabag, which I think is great, but people loved eulogizing about Fleabag. Whereas King Gary's got real broad appeal and it's done really well numbers wise, but you don't hear as much about it.
Being based in football for a lot of my life, producing and presenting shows around there, working for both Sky and BT, I can tell you that the channels do become very subservient to the loud minority. And I've been in so many meetings. I mean, Soccer AM, I used to just go, oh, Christ, ignore the fanzines and ignore all the loud people, because the majority of our audience are sitting in an armchair watching TV. And I remember having a meeting at BT Sport once and someone saying, if we do this, then the core football fans. Right? And I said, the core football fans, forget them. They're going to go whether you like it or not, home and away. Mm. You know what? The majority of us sit there wanting to have some fun, wanting to be entertained.
Yeah.
Our TV sitting, most of us are armchair fans because most of us consume most of our football via Sky or BT or BBC or however, and that's what you should be doing, is making us something friendly for those people. But you know, those loud fans, they can sometimes be very powerful.
Yeah, and you know, this desire for TV shows to be noisy, you know, that's like a buzzword in the industry. But it's almost like, if we wanted to do a really tortured football analogy, you know, Alex Ferguson, how many seasons did they give him at United? People always use that, don't they? Yeah. Like before they had success. Not that any football fan would tolerate their manager being crap for that long, by the way. We're such hypocrites in football. But it's also the same with comedy and entertainment thing. You know, it's become, social media has led a very temporary response to television. And I really hope that we correct back away from that. And I think that there are some promising signs that we might be.
I think about a really good analogy in football is, because I do a football podcast. Well, actually, I've stopped doing it. I did it for a while. And one of the things which really grates me is the fact that the pundits have all sort of, they're all towing the same line at the moment, right? And they're all, but they're not, it's really good seeing football fans suddenly come back into the stadiums because they're not towing the line. They want to see tackles, right? Contact's gone from the game now. Michael Owen, Gary Neville, Jamie Carragher, whoever you speak to, it's like, it's contact, so he's got the right to go down. He's got the right to cheat the public. He's got the right to cheat the ref. You know, it's no, he fucking hasn't. He's got the right to stay on his bloody feet and play football, which is what we want to watch. But they've all gone down this line now. So, you know, Mo Salah goes down, but he was touched on the shoulder and his legs have gone from him. It's like, but he was touched. Not there he wasn't. You know, and Graham Souness is that, I'm funny because I've got a love-hate with Graham Souness. That's why he's a good pundit. But so he was sitting there and he constantly sits there. Like, it was Michael Richards the other day was saying, you know, they have to buy Jack Grealish. Man United have to buy Jack Grealish because he's brilliant at buying a foul, right? And Graham Souness is going, or winning a foul, either one. And Graham Souness is going, it's kind of cheating though, isn't it? And Michael Richards is going, no, he's buying a foul. That's what you're supposed to. And Graham Souness said, yeah, but it's cheating. And everyone else is looking like he's mental because he's actually like
from another era.
And saying what we're all thinking at home, it's like, stay on your bloody feet. We want to see tackles and want to see challenges.
Yeah, I mean, I would sound like an old. I supported Wimbledon during the crazy gang era. I love a bit of violence on the pitch. I don't want anyone to get hurt. But that old thing of when you're going like, right, who are the two midfield hard men and waiting for them to I mean, like, just seeing that first tackle go in. And football has become, I don't care if I do sound like sort of misty eye, it has become sanitized in so many ways. But one of the great things about that cup final, I know the result didn't go the way that you wanted to, but was hearing booing again in a stadium. And it's terrible to say, but like when they programmed all the crowd noises, we live in this PC, risk-averse world. The one noise you never heard was just contempt, bitterness, and the vitriol of men that are trying to put all of their problems in life onto a football pitch. But the truth is, that's what creates the jeopardy in football, is this not toxic atmosphere, but a febrile atmosphere. And it was great too. There was something that happened very early on, and I heard booing, and my heart sang, Tim, just to hear that back again.
At the end of the Chelsea Leicester match last night, I don't know when this is going to go in, a couple of weeks. So there was a full on scrap between all the bench and there were the players, and brilliant. Everyone was loving it. But the pundits are really struggling with it because you know they're going, yes, yeah, at last we got passion back. But they're going, like you've just said, I love a bit of violence, but I don't want anyone to get hurt. Sadly. Violence, people do get hurt. It's like, yeah. I'd love to watch a bit of MMA. I love a bit of that. I love UFC, but I don't want anyone to get hurt. It's like, well,
but you know, with the modern footballer, even when it was so-called more violent, they never really threw a punch, footballers. They're not about that. But it was, what was it? It was the melee, the scuffle, the brawl, you know. Yeah,
I just want people to try and win a football without the opposition. I mean, I blame Sir Alex Ferguson for a bit of this because he started getting all the Ronaldos and stuff, and he started going to, before the match, he started hammering the refs, and he had so much power, and he started going, they don't look after Ronaldo. And Ronaldo used to stand up, pick the ball up half the time if anyone came close to him, and then look at the ref and go, that's a foul. And it started being like American football, like, you know, you're going for yardage as he was getting fouled because people kept touching him. And it sort of eked its way into the Premier League now, that they just go down constantly. And last night, because the fans were there, it seemed to have a slight change. The players were like, I want to stay on my feet. Because it seemed to really change last night.
It's just a matter of honour. You know what I mean? A matter of honour. When you've got an audience. I mean, I would say, I'm an AFC Wimbledon fan. If you want something, League One is such a sweet spot, Tim, for the good old days, you know, because the cuisine still smells. It's better than it was, but it's a bit off. But you get that sweaty burger smell in the air. You still get the odd clogger there, you know, like from one of the League Two teams that has recently come up. He looks like he still probably works two jobs. You know, you get one of those guys. But you also get a sort of reunion of the kind of top flight of the early 90s. Every once in a while, there'll be like Derby there, Sunderland, Millwall. You know, there'll be enough clubs around it. This is terrible to say, but I love League One. I it'd be brilliant if we didn't have a relegation struggle every season. But having been on that journey of what happened to my football club, I just want the football club to exist and play at a decent level.
Well, Chris England, so we're getting a bit footbally here, but I will move on. But Chris England, who's a great author, he wrote the play An Evening with Gary Lineker. He's got this book called On the Game, How Chris England on the Game, How Football Became What It Is Today. And he came on my podcast for a little chat, and he said, the pundits believe what we want to watch is this beautiful game with all these little triangles passing down. He goes, they don't understand what we want to watch is 11 blokes hurting themselves at 11 other blokes, basically. And every now and then there's a skillful fella there as well, who's, you know, George Best, who's taking them on, or whoever it is, Zola.
Well, that's why cricket worked so well without a crowd, because cricket is essentially, there's a lot of bad stuff, and then when the good stuff happens, that's what makes it's so beautiful. But with football, I was raised on Vinnie Jones, John Fashanu, Dave Besson. I was sort of... I was indoctrinated into a slightly violent brand of it. So maybe I sort of need a version of football counselling.
Yeah, what I hate about that Wimbledon team is we ended up buying them all, Chelsea, in the end.
You and Tottenham, mate. It was like the bank of mum and dad.
All right, look, I'm going to go on to my favourite question, then we'll go back, because I'm worried we're going to run out of time here. Have you ever seen a ghost or a UFO, Jeff?
No, I haven't seen them. I don't believe in them, but I believe in some things that would be seen as slightly supernatural. Like I sort of believe in deja vu, and that is arguably weirder, right? when you actually unpick it, to sort of believe that there's this parallel existence that's come back to give me a little bit of a warning of something that's already happened. I'm not sure how that is in, you know, a more likely thing than that there is life out there in other galaxies that has paid us a visit. But yeah, deja vu, I get it. I get it quite a lot.
Do you know what? I've not thought about deja vu for a very, very long time. And I've not had it, I don't think, for 20 odd years. What do you think it actually is then?
I honestly don't. I think it's weird, isn't it? Because it's just a bit like seeing, you know, when you see in your eye those weird little things, those floaty things in your eye. And then the moment you go and look at them, they're gone, right?
Yeah.
Deja vu is exactly like that. You can break the spell of it. And I don't know if it's just a moment is reminiscent to a point where you get that, but then sometimes it's impossible. I have no idea what it is. So what? In a way, the reason I'm saying that is I'm not like pissing on these things because I'm aware that I do have that, but I've never got. And with a ghost, nothing even close.
No, I'm desperate to see a ghost. I've never seen one. And I'm so interested in UFOs and I spend a lot of time reading up. I don't believe in it, by the way. I've never had any proof, but I spend a lot of time online looking at videos. I follow a lot of accounts, you know, and I listen to podcasts where they tell me all about the aliens and what's happened. And I love meeting people who've said they've seen a UFO because they believe it, you know, it's like they genuinely believe it. I don't know. I just want in my lifetime to be visited by aliens, you know?
I'm a big science fiction fan. I absolutely love Star Wars. I think the big risk is that it really doesn't deliver, you know, like against what I've always kind of hoped is out there in a galaxy far, far away. Like, that the first, it'd just be some sloppy amorphous blob, won't there? And I think like the first alien that we find is just gonna look like stew, probably.
Yeah. All right, I'll do another question. What's the happiest you've ever felt?
The happiest I've ever felt? I'd have to say it's got to be, I mean, it's a bit of a corny answer, but it's got to be the birth of my son. Because when he came out, I went, oh God. Like I said, oh God. Like I'm sort of quasi-religious, but I just said it, right? It was completely reflexive. I thought, if something's happened that's made me immediately refer to sort of a benevolent creator, I think this is probably a good moment. You know, hearing him cry for the first time is just a brilliant sound. And it's really weird because it just let me know that he was all right and he'd come out okay and stuff. But what it means is, I love that sound so much that when he was a toddler, when he cried, I quite like the sound of him crying. That's not right, you know. But there's, you know what it's like having kids. There's a different kind of crying, the grizzling, you know, the kind when something's gone really wrong. I always found that because it just took me back. What I probably should have been doing is attending to why he was crying, but I was going, oh, that takes me back, boy. Hey? You cry. He's like, yeah, any chance you could put some antiseptic on my knee that I've just cut? I was like, yeah, I'll get to that in a minute. But oh, that day you was born, what a beautiful day that was. But yeah, I think that's the happiest I've ever felt.
Yeah. All right. Tell our listeners something that has been life-changing for you. You got anything like that?
Life-changing for me, I probably counselling in a way, because I went through a period, I mean, it's quite late in the interview to get too heavy with this, but I went through like a run of griefs, a run of loss in the middle of the last decade. And it kind of just, it was either like I tried to get to grips with it or I'd have gone under. And it's an almost magical thing to me, counselling, where you just sit there and you talk with this person. And then every so often you just come across a feeling or a sentiment or a sentence and you just say it and you kind of, you know, you can feel something changing in you it's that old phrase, isn't it? Lightening the load, you know, weight off your shoulders. Problem aired is a problem in halves. All that, it's all true. And then it's magical to me that you can just say that. And then for the next week, you can feel happier that you just got this stuff off your chest. I mean, it's interesting with blokes because it is still a harder sell with blokes. But what I found is if you're recommending counselling to a real blokey bloke, I often tell them, and this is true, I say, well, the American military use it, Dave. And the moment you drop the American military, they're like, do they now? You're like, yeah. And you know as well as I do, Dave, that they don't mess about those boys. So just saying, is it worth the American military use? I'm like, well, yeah, they kind of do. So I'm a believer in it. I'm also a believer in that it can just be moaning and whining. And you really have to judge that point where you need to give yourself a kick up the arse, right? There's a balancing act. But it's just part of, you know, it just helps me start to feel better. And just knowing that it's an option is useful to me.
There's something about telling something to a stranger then, because they always say, I agree with you, by the way. They always say talk to your friends and family. It's not quite the same because they're invested in you, aren't they? When you tell a stranger, it's just there's something more of a release when you do it. I've done quite a bit of therapy in my life, and it's just, yeah, I agree. It's a really good thing to do. I had a very similar thing. A bloke, I think I might have said this on the podcast not so long ago, some bloke who's a builder wandered up to me and said, you, because I just went to all my mates, oh, I've been doing therapy. And he said, that therapy, do you think it would work on with me? And it was like, he just wanted me to say, yeah. And then he could say, well, Tim said I could do it. So, you know, it's like, it's fine.
Lovejoy said, so, you know, yeah. Lovejoy said it. Yeah. No, I think it's so, I think it's so powerful. I mean, there is that time, you got to pick the right therapist, like, because like any job, sometimes they phone it in. And there's so many times they can go, oh, that must have been very difficult for you. Where you almost sort of go, hang on, I feel like I could just say anything and all you would say is that must have been very hard for you. And you kind of, it's nice just to get that sympathy. But you're absolutely right. When you speak to friends or family about it, you don't realise you're doing it, but you're managing a version of yourself. You know, you're trying to be, we're all sort of sitcom characters in our own lives to varying degrees, and you're different people with different sort of friends and relatives. So just shedding that. And then the other bit of advice I got from my mate, who's like quite a high-ranking psychiatrist, is he just said, to get your money's worth, and this again is a good sell to blokes, to get your money's worth is be as brave as you can. So whatever dark shit, weird stuff in your head, you know, things that you, it's almost always stuff that other people feel, just get it all out. But he put it to me, he said, just make sure you get your money's worth. And again, I was like, I will get my money's worth.
I said to a shrink recently, did your client...
So I just froze there for a sec.
Do your clients speak to you about everything? And he goes, yeah, pretty much so. He goes, what about, they talk a lot about sex. And he says, yeah, they'll talk about anything like that. And then he said, actually, he goes, I often get clients come in and they say, ask me anything, tell me, I will tell you absolutely anything. I'm an open book, I'm here. You know, like you're saying, to get my money's worth. And he always says to them, first question, he says, how much money do you earn? They go, well, I'm not telling you that. And he says, that's the one thing British people never tell anyone. Never.
That's hilarious. That's a bit personal, mate. Oh, yeah. I mean, like, I told you that I was actually raised by my nan, who turned out to be my sister. But you asked me how much money I earn. I'm taking a piss.
Right. Final question. We never made 15, but we never do on this podcast. What's the meaning of life?
I just think to be content. There was a long time where I thought it was happy, but I sort of realised that happy isn't always good. So last week, book comes out, early sales are good, everything's good, I was buzzing. I don't think that buzzing me is definitely the best me. I probably wasn't as good a husband and father during that period, you know what I mean? Like, because it gets addictive, isn't it? Then you just want to think about this thing that you got going on. So just contentness. Yeah, just to be all right in a situation, because happy is a tricksy mistress, isn't it? You go, oh, I'm really happy today. We go, well, that's only going one way, isn't it? You know, which maybe to, if there's a therapist listening, go, well, that sounds like a depressive way of doing it. But it's probably a more middle-aged mindset. You've just been through enough of these vicissitudes of life where you go, steady would be good.
Yeah. Jeff, thanks so much for doing the podcast. Your book, Where Did I Go Right, is out now. And listen to his podcast as well, What Most People Think. Cheers, mate. Top man.
Cheers. Thank you.